This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for March 17, 2014. It was, as usual, an interesting week, beginning with Notice 2014-17, in which the IRS explains the tax treatment of per capita distributions to members of Indian tribes, followed by Revenue Procedure 2014-24, in which the IRS provides guidance on failure to file the affiliated group form when a corporation joins a consolidated return and fails to file the Form 1122, what relief is available and under what terms and conditions. Then, in Julie Oderio, we learn that the husband's activity does not accept a wife who files separately from passive activity rules. Only if they file jointly does the wife get the benefit of the husband's participation in real estate activities. Then, in Douglas Lamarck Burse, the tax court upholds the IRS's deficiency determination against an individual who was not entitled to the dependency exemption, head of household status, or the earned income tax credit for his stepdaughter. Then, a field attorney advisory explaining that self-insured taxpayers' legal fees don't qualify as specified liability losses. That's a workers' compensation legal fee case, very interesting fact pattern. Then, in Patrick Wachter, we learn that state law in North Dakota precludes a charitable contribution of an easement because no easement in North Dakota can extend for a period beyond 99 years, which trumps the perpetuity provision. Next, the Ninth Circuit affirms the denial of an estate's deduction for uncertain litigation claim in the estate of Gertrude Saunders. We once again have affirmed that whether a claim against the estate is likely or not likely may have something to do with whether it can be estimated in the final estate tax return. And then, a very interesting decision coming out of the Court of Federal Claims. Joseph Nacio, you may remember he was the chief executive of Quest, was convicted of manipulating the stock price. The Court of Federal Claims held that he wasn't precluded by public policy or Section 162F from deducting as a loss under 165 the amounts he forfeited after his insider trading conviction. We'll dig into that in a little more detail. So let's begin with Notice 2014-17. This interim guidance provides that per capita distributions made from funds the Interior Department Secretary holds in a trust account for the benefit of a tribe are generally excluded from the gross income of the members of the tribe receiving the per capita distributions. Proceeds from timber sales, an agricultural lease, a grazing permit are typically deposited into a tribe's trust account. Subsequently, then per capita distributions using trust account funds are made to individual tribal members. However, distributions to tribal members from a tribal trust account constitute gross income under Section 61 to the members of the tribe receiving the distributions if a trust account is used to mischaracterize taxable income as non-taxable per capita distributions. Distributions from a tribal trust account constitute gross income under Section 61 if the distributions are mischaracterized as compensation to tribal members for their services, mischaracterized distributions of business profits, or mischaracterized gaming revenues. The guidance, the Notice 2014-17, provides several examples providing that illustrate those situations. This guidance applies only to per capita distributions made by the Interior Department Secretary or an Indian tribe out of a tribal trust account. The guidance does not affect federal income taxation of distributions made from an individual Indian's trust account, from which per capita distributions, of course, cannot be made. The purpose of this notice is that the IRS is responding to some misunderstanding and mischaracterization of distributions, attempts by tribal elders, in many cases, to distribute money to themselves for services rendered to the tribe and treat that as a non-taxable per capita distribution. Next, Revenue Procedure 2014-24 describes the conditions under which a member of an affiliated group that failed to file a Form 1122, and the title of that form is authorization and consent of subsidiary corporation to be included in a consolidated income tax return can be treated as if it filed the form and thus joined in the making of a consolidated return by the group. Under Revenue Procedure 2014-24, a subsidiary that failed to file a Form 1122 is automatically treated as though it filed the form if it meets the following criteria. 1. The affiliated group timely filed what was purported to be a consolidated return for the tax year, either including Form 851 affiliation schedule with the affiliated group's return or providing some other clear and unequivocal indication on the return that the return was intended as a consolidated return for the affiliated group, which included the corporation that failed to file a Form 1122. 2. The non-filing subsidiary was not prevented from joining in the filing of the consolidated return by any applicable rule of law other than the failure to file Form 1122. 3. A separate return was not filed by the non-filing subsidiary for any period of time included in the consolidated return or any subsequent tax year other than a separate return for a period in which the non-filing subsidiary's income and deductions were not properly includable in the affiliated groups. And finally, 4. Any one of 3 specified reasons for non-filing existed. What are those 3 specified reasons? The consolidated return did not include a Form 1122 for the non-filing subsidiary due to a mistake of law or fact or to inadvertence, provided that the affiliated group believed that the non-filing subsidiary was a member of the affiliated group for the taxable year and included the non-filing subsidiary's income and deductions in the consolidated return as if the subsidiary was a member of the affiliated group. 2. The consolidated return did not include a Form 1122 for the non-filing subsidiary due to a mistake of law or fact or to inadvertence, provided that all of the non-filing subsidiary's income and deductions were included on the consolidated return as part of the income and deductions of another member of the group. For example, if the affiliated group believed that the non-filing subsidiary was disregarded as an entity separate from its owner for federal income tax purposes or had formally ceased to exist pursuant to a merger or liquidation into another member of the group. And finally, the third condition, and of course this is any one of these 3, the consolidated return did not include a Form 1122 for the non-filing subsidiary because the affiliated group believed that the non-filing subsidiary was taxable as a partnership for federal income tax purposes, provided that all of the non-filing subsidiary's income and deductions were included on the consolidated return as part of the income and deductions of its partners. By the way, there's one sentence in that revenue ruling. The commissioner on his own accord or at the request of the common parent of the affiliated group may, upon examination, determine, pursuant to Regulation 1.1502-75, based on the standards described therein, that a subsidiary is treated as if it filed a Form 1122, and that would be a separate route for securing relief from the failure to file the Form 1122. In short, failing to file the Form 1122 with a consolidated return is probably not a big deal, but the authority for making it not a big deal is this revenue procedure. Next, in Julie Oderio, TC Memo 2014-39, the tax court does not allow Ms. Oderio's rental losses as passive activity losses under Section 469. Her husband satisfied the material participation requirement in Code Section 469C7B, but that material participation did not extend to her filing of a separate return. We know that rental activity of a taxpayer is not treated as per se passive if the taxpayer satisfies the requirements of Code Section 469C7B. A taxpayer meets those requirements if they establish the following. 1. More than one half of the personal services performed in trades or businesses by the taxpayer during the taxable year are performed in real property trades or businesses in which the taxpayer materially participates, and the taxpayer performs more than 750 hours of services during the taxable year in real property trades or businesses in which the taxpayer materially participates. In the case of a joint return, the requirements of that preceding sentence are satisfied if and only if either spouse separately satisfies those requirements, but that is in the case of a joint return. The regulation, pertinent regulation here, 1.469-9C4, clarifying the scope of attribution as it relates to satisfying the requirements of 469C7B, says, in determining the real property trades or businesses in which a married taxpayer materially participates, parentheses, but not for any other purpose under this paragraph, close paren, work performed by the taxpayer's spouse in a trade or business is treated as work performed by the taxpayer, regardless of whether the taxpayers file a joint return. And this is where this taxpayer misunderstood or misread the rules. The parenthetical, but not for any other purpose under this paragraph, limits the use of spousal attribution for purposes of satisfying the Section 469C7B requirements to the material participation requirements of that section. While the regulation allows for spousal attribution with respect to material participation, it does not allow for spousal attribution for purposes of meeting its other requirements, namely, that a taxpayer perform more than one-half for his or personal services and more than 750 hours in real estate, trades, or businesses, which Mrs. O'Dario did not. Next, Douglas Lamarck Burse, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2014-21. Mr. Burse was not entitled to the dependency exemption deduction, head of household status, or the earned income tax credit for his stepdaughter, who was a full-time student living on campus, and he wasn't entitled to education credits. During the year in question, the taxpayer was employed part-time at a modest hourly rate at a local high school, working approximately 30 hours per week for the 9 or 10 months during the year that school was in session. Throughout the year, the taxpayer lived with his mother. As he was, to use his own words, on hard times, he tried to contribute to the cost of maintaining the household by paying the light bill or some monthly amount, but was, again in his own words, short on it sometimes. Well, first of all, the taxpayer's living with his mother. He's not maintaining a household for the principal place of abode for himself and a dependent. Second, he wasn't entitled to the dependency exemption deduction because there was no evidence that he provided more than one half of the income of the stepdaughter, and he wasn't entitled to the earned income credit, and he wasn't entitled to the American Opportunity credit. It comes under the heading, I suppose, of nice try, but no cigar. Our next item is a field attorney advisory 20141002F, titled Self-Insured Taxpayers' Legal Fees Don't Qualify as Specified Liability Losses. Now first, let's talk about what a specified liability loss is. Section 162F defines a specified liability loss as the sum of certain enumerated deductions to the extent taken into account in computing the net operating loss for a taxable year. Section 172F1B provides that a liability shall be taken into account under Section 172F1B only if, 1, the act or failure to act giving rise to such liability occurs at least 3 years before the beginning of the taxable year, and 2, the taxpayer used an accrual method of accounting throughout the period or periods during which such act or failure to act occurred. Essentially, the net operating loss carryback period for a specified liability loss is 10 years, which makes the designation as a specified liability loss fairly attractive. In the instant case, we've got a corporate taxpayer who is self-insured as to workers' compensation. When audited, they were unable to show that the provisions of state worker compensation acts required the employer to pay legal fees incurred in contesting or investigating a worker compensation claim. The IRS concluded in the work preceded this advisory that the taxpayer had failed to show that the acts giving rise to the legal fees and expenses occurred at least 3 years before the beginning of the tax year, as required by the 3-year rule of Section 172. For the deductions for legal fees and other expenses incurred to qualify as a specified liability loss, the taxpayer must establish that the amounts allowable as deductions are in satisfaction of liabilities under a federal or state law requiring a payment under a Worker Compensation Act within the meaning of Code Section 461H2. So the taxpayer's attempt to classify those legal fees as specified liability losses failed on both counts. One, they couldn't prove that the liability arose more than 3 years before the current year, and they were unable to prove that they were required to pay the legal fees under the terms of state or federal law. That meant, of course, they did not get the benefit of a 10-year carryback. In Patrick J. Wachter, 142 TC No. 7, The tax court rules that two couples were not entitled to charitable contribution deductions for the bargain sale of easements in North Dakota, finding that the easements weren't qualified real property interests because North Dakota law restricted easements to 99 years, and that prevented the granting of the easements in perpetuity as required by Internal Revenue Code Section 170H. There are really two issues involved here. The IRS got summary judgment on this issue as to whether or not there was a charitable contribution or a charitable sale, bargain sale, of an easement. But I think it's important to understand here that this is not a gimmick or a scheme. The Wachters were giving from $72,000 to $85,000 a year in cash to rehabilitate wetlands in North Dakota. So this was part of a real substantive attempt to do something good. The other piece, the documentation for the cash distributions, appears to have some technical difficulties. That is, the written acknowledgments of the receipt of the cash distributions did not state that the Wachters got no benefit. So the court has ordered that that issue be held over for trial. There is, of course, the possibility that the checks and letters for each year of 2004, 5, and 6, as well as a written agreement in 2004, can be taken together to meet the requirements of a contemporaneous written acknowledgement. Now, the tax court addressed that in Irby 139 TC 371 back in 2012 when they held that a series of documents may constitute a contemporaneous written acknowledgement, and the court observes that the Wachters may yet be able to authenticate the disputed deductibility of cash contributions. And so that one's going to go to trial. On the other issue, the IRS got summary judgment because state law says you can't have a qualified conservation easement in North Dakota. In Estate of Gertrude Saunders, the Ninth Circuit affirmed a tax court decision that an estate was not entitled to a $30 million deduction for a claim against it because the value of the claim was not ascertainable with reasonable certainty at the time of the decedent's death, and ultimately allowed a deduction for the amount for which the claim was actually settled, which was $250,000. Now, that's a big spread. Let's talk about how the court looks at the viability of a claim against an estate when the ultimate settlement is, in fact, uncertain. It is necessary to value the claim. But in this particular case, the experts' opinions varied widely. One valuator, Perkin, opined that given the wide range of unknowns as of November 2003, the claim was worth $30 million. He acknowledged, however, that an adverse judgment could result in liability ranging between $1 and $90 million. In a 2009 update, that same expert revised his valuation downward to $25 million. Another valuation expert came up with $19.3 million, yet a third, $22.5 million. The IRS experts calculated much lower estimates. According to one, the claim was worth at most $3.6 million on the date of Gertrude's death, but ultimately ruling that the only deduction the estate could claim was what they paid, the $250,000. And here's the analysis. I'll just read what the judge wrote. We have applied the regulations at issue in this case several times. In so doing, we have classified claims as either certain and enforceable on the one hand, or disputed and contingent on the other. This distinction governs whether courts may consider post-death events, such as the settlement here, when determining the permissible deduction for claims against an estate. In Propstra, a case which is cited as precedent, we held that when claims are for sums certain and are legally enforceable as of the date of death, post-death events are not relevant in computing the permissible deduction. We also held, however, that post-death events are relevant when computing the deduction to be taken for disputed or contingent claims. Thus, under our case law, courts may consider post-death events when valuing a disputed or contingent claim against an estate, and the court here cites NAIFY, N-A-I-F-Y, 672 Federal 2nd at 628. And of course, you'll find all of this in the, you can access this case in the citations which accompany this podcast. Citations appear in somewhere on the website where you got the podcast as a Word document. So the conclusion here, since the claim's estimated date of death value was not ascertainable with reasonable certainty, the only course of action the court could take was to uphold the amount that was actually paid, the $250,000, not the $30 million. That increased the estate tax, by the way, by about $14 million, just to help you keep it in focus. Finally this week, we have Joseph P. Nacio, an individual former chief executive officer of Quest. The court rules that he is not precluded by public policy or Section 162F from deducting as a loss under Section 165 the amounts he forfeited after his insider trading conviction. The court, however, did hold that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether he believed he had a claim of right to the forfeited stock proceeds. Now, if he has a claim of right, then he's got a Section 1341 calculation. But let's talk first of all about the amounts he forfeited. To qualify for a tax refund, Mr. Nacio is going to have to establish that he believed he had a claim of right, that is, that he was required by law to include the income that he gained from his scheme to inflate his stock profits, included in his 2001 joint return, and that they're entitled to deduct the amount forfeited under a separate section of the Internal Revenue Code. They claim either 162 or 165. The government says that because Mr. Nacio's forfeiture was imposed as punishment for insider trading, permitting a deduction would contravene both public policy and the prohibition in Section 162F against the deduction of a fine or similar penalty. The problem the government has is that forfeiture was not a fine or similar penalty. There was, in Mr. Nacio's case, a separate amount assessed as a fine. The court goes on to say that they are going to grant Mr. Nacio's motion in part. They find that he may deduct the amounts forfeited as a loss under Section 165, but they're not sure whether he believed he had a claim of right to the trading proceeds, and that's a genuine issue of material fact on which they're probably going to have a trial. The other issue, the fact that he can claim the loss, he's won on summary judgment. The Colorado District Court, where Mr. Nacio was tried, sentenced him to serve 72 months in prison, pay a $19 million fine, and forfeit the gross income derived from insider trading in the amount of $52,007,545.47. That decision went up and back, but eventually, on remand, en banc panel of the Tenth Circuit held that the district court erred by requiring Mr. Nacio to forfeit his gross income rather than his net gain, and directed that the $19 million fine be deposited into the crime victims fund, but the forfeiture was reserved separately to compensate the victims of the insider trading, and that was critical to the decision in this case. Because he forfeited his gain from insider trading as property which constitutes and is derived from proceeds traceable to securities fraud, the forfeitable proceeds were subject to remission, which is what happened. They sequestered the money, and they to the extent that they could, they made some of Mr. Nacio's victims whole. Mr. Nacio amended his tax return in March 2009, claiming a $17,999,000 credit pursuant to Section 1341, the claim of right doctrine, which can be invoked only after a valid deduction is claimed pursuant to another code section. So Mr. Nacio believed he had to report the income back in 2001. He did not get to keep the money. He had to give it back. Therefore, he should be able to recover the amount of tax that he paid on the money. That's the essence of Code Section 1341, and that's what the court said they're going to have a trial to determine whether it was reasonable and whether Mr. Nacio's claim actually meets the fairly strict requirements of Section 1341. If it does, then he's going to get some money right away. If it doesn't, then the best he's got is a net operating loss carryback and carry forward, which may not do him any good because I imagine his opportunities for making very much money are probably past. Well, that's it for this week, folks. As usual, our advice is stay safe.